Now, lying here in the house on the shore of Kashwakamok Lake, she wondered what had happened to the tearless, eerily calm blonde girl who had told them about her brother Barry and Barry's friends. Young men who had clearly felt a woman was just a life support system for a cunt, and that branding was a perfectly just punishment for a young woman who felt more or less okay about fucking her brother, but not her brother's good buddies. More to the point, Jessie wondered what she had said to Ruth as they sat with their backs against the locked kitchen door and their arms around each other. The only thing she could remember for sure was something like, "He never burned me. He never burned me. He never hurt me at all." But there must have been more to it than that, because the questions Ruth had refused to stop asking had all pointed clearly in just one direction, toward Darkscore Lake and the day the sun had gone out. She had finally left Ruth rather than tell, just as she had left Nora rather than tell. She had run just as fast as her legs could carry her. Jessie Mayhoot Burlingame, also known as the Amazing Gingerbread Girl, the last wonder of a dubious age, survivor of the day the sun had gone out, now handcuffed to the bed and able to run no more. "Help me," she said to the empty bedroom. Now that she had remembered the blonde girl with the eerily calm face and voice, and the stipple of old circular scars on her otherwise lovely breasts, Jessie could not get her out of her mind, nor the knowledge that it hadn't been calmness, not at all, but some fundamental disconnection from the terrible thing that had happened to her. Somehow the blonde girl's face became her face, and when Jessie spoke, she did so in the shaking, humbled voice of an atheist who has been stripped of everything but one final, long-shot prayer. "Please, help me." It wasn't God who answered, but the part of her which could apparently only speak while masquerading as Ruth Neary. The voice now sounded gentle, but not very hopeful. "I'll try, but you have to help me. I know you're willing to do painful things, but you may have to think painful thoughts, too. Are you ready for that?" "This isn't about thinking," Jessie said shakily, and thought, "So that's what the Good Wife Burlingame sounds like out loud. It's about, well, escaping." "And you may have to muzzle her," Ruth said. "She's a valid part of you, Jessie, of us, and not really a bad person. But she's been left to run the whole show for far too long, and in a situation like this, her way of dealing with the world is not much good. Do you want to argue the point?" Jessie didn't want to argue that point or any other. She was too tired. The light falling through the west window was growing steadily hotter and redder as sunset approached. The wind gusted, sending leaves rattling along the lakeside deck, which was empty now. All the deck furniture had been stacked in the living room. The pines soft. The back door banged. The dog paused, then resumed its noisome smacking and ripping and chewing. "I'm so thirsty," she said mournfully. "Okay, then. That's where we ought to start." She turned her head the other way until she felt the last warmth of the sun on the left side of her neck, and the damp hair stuck to her cheek. And then she opened her eyes again. She found herself staring directly at Gerald's glass of water, and her throat immediately sent out a parched, imperative cry. "Let's begin this phase of operations by forgetting about the dog," Ruth said. "The dog is just doing what it has to do to get along, and you've got to do the same."
"I don't know if I can forget it," Jessie said.
"I think you can, Toots. I really do. If you could sweep what happened on the day the sun went out under the rug, I guess you can sweep anything under the rug." For a moment, she almost had it all, and understood she could have it all if she really wanted to. The secret of that day had never been completely sunk in her subconscious, as such secrets were in the TV soap operas and the movie melodramas. It had been buried in a shallow grave at best. There had been some selective amnesia, but of a completely voluntary sort. If she wanted to remember what had happened on the day the sun had gone out, she thought she probably could. As if this idea had been an invitation, her mind's eye suddenly saw a vision of heartbreaking clarity. A pane of glass held in a pair of barbecue tongs. A hand wearing an oven mitt was turning it this way and that in the smoke of a small sod fire. Jessie stiffened on the bed and willed the image away. "Let's get one thing straight," she thought. She supposed it was the Ruth voice she was speaking to, but wasn't completely sure. She wasn't really sure of anything anymore. "I don't want to remember. Got it? The events of that day have nothing to do with the events of this one. They're apples and oranges. It's easy enough to understand the connections. Two lakes, two summer houses, two cases of secret silence, hurt, harm, sexual hanky-panky. But remembering what happened in 1963 can't do a thing for me now except add to my general misery. So let's just drop that whole subject, okay? Let's just forget Dark Score Lake. What do you say, Ruth?" she asked in a low voice, and her gaze shifted to the batik butterfly across the room. For just a moment there was another image, a little girl, somebody's sweet little pumpkin, smelling the sweet aroma of aftershave, and looking up into the sky through a piece of smoked glass. And then it was mercifully gone. She looked at the butterfly for a few moments longer, wanting to make sure those old memories were going to stay gone. And then she looked back at Gerald's glass of water. Incredibly, there were still a few slivers of ice floating on top, although the darkening room continued to hold the heat of the afternoon sun and would for a while longer. Jessie let her gaze drift down the glass, let it embrace those chilly bubbles of condensation standing out on it. She couldn't actually see the coaster on which the glass stood. The shelf cut it off. But she didn't have to see it to visualize the dark, spreading ring of moisture forming on it, as those cool beads of condensate continued to trickle down the sides of the glass and pool around it at the bottom. Jessie's tongue slipped out and swiped across her upper lip, not imparting much moisture. "I want a drink!" the scared, demanding voice of the child, of somebody's sweet little pumpkin, yelled. "I want it! And I want it right now!" But she couldn't reach the glass. It was a clear-cut case of so near and yet so far. "Ruth, don't give up so easy. If you could hit the goddamn dog with an ashtray, Tootsie, maybe you can get the glass. Maybe you can." Jessie raised her right hand again, straining as hard as her throbbing shoulder would allow, and still came up at least 2.5 inches short. She swallowed, grimacing at the sandpapery jerk and clench of her throat. "See?" she asked. "Are you happy now?" Ruth didn't reply, but Goody did. She spoke up softly, almost apologetically, inside Jessie's head. She said, "Get it, not reach it. They might not be the same thing." Goody laughed in an embarrassed, who-am-I-to-stick-my-oar-in way, and Jessie had a moment to think again how surpassingly odd it was to feel a part of yourself laughing like that, as if it really was an entirely separate entity. "If I had a few more voices," Jessie thought, "we could have a goddamn bridge tournament in here." She looked at the glass a moment longer, then let herself flop back down on the pillows so she could study the underside of the shelf. It wasn't attached to the wall, she saw. It lay on 4 steel brackets that looked like upside-down capital L's. And the shelf wasn't attached to them, either. She was sure of it. She remembered once when Gerald had been talking on the phone and had absent-mindedly attempted to lean on the shelf. Her end had started to come up, levitating like the end of a seesaw. And if Gerald hadn't snatched his hand away immediately, he would have flipped the shelf like a tiddlywink. The thought of the telephone distracted her for a moment, but only a moment. It sat on a low table in front of the east window, the one with its scenic view of the driveway and the Mercedes, and it might as well have been on another planet, for all the good it could do her in her current situation. Her eyes returned to the underside of the shelf, first studying the plank itself, then scanning the L-shaped brackets again. When Gerald leaned on his end, her end had tilted. If she could exert enough pressure on her end to tilt his, the glass of water, it might slide down, she said in a hoarse, musing voice. It might slide down to my end. Of course, it might go sliding gaily right past her to shatter on the floor, and it might bang into some unseen obstacle up there and overturn before it ever got to her. But it was worth trying, wasn't it? Sure, I guess so, she thought. I mean, I was planning to fly to New York in my Lear jet, eat at Four Seasons, dance the night away at Birdland. But with Gerald dead, I guess that would be a little tacky. And with all the good books currently out of reach, all the bad ones too, as far as that goes, I guess I might as well try for the consolation prize. All right. How was she supposed to go about it? Very carefully, she said. That's how. She used the handcuffs to pull herself up again and studied the glass some more. Not being able to actually see the surface of the shelf now struck her as a drawback. She had a pretty good idea of what was on her end, but was less sure about Gerald's and the no-man's land in the middle. Of course, it wasn't surprising. Who but someone with an eidetic memory could reel off a complete inventory of the items on a bedroom shelf? Who would ever have thought such things could matter? Well, they matter now. I'm living in a world where all the perspectives have changed. Yes, indeed. In this world, a stray dog could be scarier than Freddy Krueger. The phone was in the twilight zone. The sought-for desert oasis, goal of 1,000 grizzled foreign legionnaires in 100 desert romances, was a glass of water with a few last slivers of ice floating on top. In this new world order, the bedroom shelf had become a shipping lane as vital as the Panama Canal, and an old paperback western or mystery in the wrong place could become a lethal roadblock. "Don't you think you're exaggerating a little?" she asked herself uneasily, but in truth she did not. This would be a long-odds operation under the best of circumstances, but if there was junk on the runway, forget it. A single skinny Hercule Poirot, or one of the Star Trek novels Gerald read and then dropped like used napkins, wouldn't show above the angle of the shelf, but it would be more than enough to stop or overturn the water glass. No, she wasn't exaggerating. The perspectives of this world really had changed, and enough to make her think of that science fiction movie where the hero started to shrink and went on getting smaller until he was living in his daughter's dollhouse and going in fear of the family cat. She was going to learn the new rules in a hurry, learn them and live by them. "Don't lose your courage, Jessie," Ruth's voice whispered. "Don't worry," she said. "I'm going to try. I really am. But sometimes it's good to know what you're up against. I think sometimes that makes a difference." She rotated her right wrist outward from her body as far as it would go, then raised her arm. In this position, she looked like a woman's shape in a line of Egyptian pictographs. She began to patter her fingers on the shelf again, feeling for obstructions along the stretch where she hoped the glass would finish up. She touched a piece of fairly heavy-gauge paper and thumbed it for a moment, trying to think what it could be. Her first guess was a sheet from the notepad that usually hid in the clutter on the telephone table, but it wasn't thin enough for that. Her eye happened on a magazine, either Time or Newsweek, Gerald had brought both along, lying face down beside the phone. She remembered him thumbing rapidly through one of the magazines while he took off his socks and unbuttoned his shirt. The piece of paper on the shelf was probably one of those annoying blow-in subscription cards with which the newsstand copies of magazines are always loaded. Gerald often laid such cards aside for later use as bookmarks. It might be something else, but Jessie decided it didn't matter to her plans in any case. It wasn't solid enough to stop the glass or overturn it. There was nothing else up there, at least within reach of her stretching, wriggling fingers. "Okay," Jessie said. Her heart had started to pound hard. Some sadistic pirate broadcaster in her mind tried to transmit a picture of the glass tumbling off the shelf, and she immediately blocked the image out. Easy. Easy does it. Slow and easy wins the race. I hope. Holding her right hand right where it was, although bending it away from her body in that direction didn't work very well and hurt like the devil, Jessie raised her left hand, my ashtray-throwing hand, she thought with a grim glint of humor, and gripped the shelf with it well beyond the last supporting bracket on her side of the bed. Here we go, she thought, and began to exert downward pressure with her left hand. Nothing happened. I'm probably pulling too close to that last bracket to get enough leverage. The problem is the goddamn handcuff chain. I don't have enough slack to get as far out on the shelf as I need to be. Probably true. But the insight didn't change the fact that she wasn't doing a thing to the shelf with her left hand where it was. She would have to spider her fingers out a little further, if she could, that was, and hope it would be enough. It was funny book physics, simple but deadly. The irony was that she could reach under the shelf and push it up any time she liked. There was one small problem with that, however. It would tip the glass the wrong way, off Gerald's end and onto the floor. When you considered it closely, you saw that the situation really did have its amusing side. It was like an America's Funniest Home Video segment sent in from hell. Suddenly the wind dropped, and the sounds from the entry seemed very loud.
Are you enjoying him, shithead?
Jessie screamed. Pain ripped at her throat, but she couldn't stop.
I hope so, because the first thing I'm going to do when I get out of these cuffs is blow your head off.
Big talk, she thought. Very big talk for a woman who no longer even remembers if Gerald's old shotgun, the one that belonged to his dad, is here or in the attic of the Portland house. Nevertheless, there was a gratifying moment of silence from the shadowy world beyond the bedroom door. It was almost as if the dog was giving this threat its soberest, most thoughtful consideration. Then the smackings and chewings began again. Jessie's right wrist twanged warningly, threatening to cramp up, warning her that she had better get on with her business right away, if she actually had any business to do, that was. She leaned to the left and stretched her hand as far as the chain would allow. Then she began to put on the pressure again. At first there was nothing. She pulled harder, eyes slitted almost shut, the corners of her mouth turned down. It was the face of a child who expects a dose of bad medicine. And just before she reached the maximum downward pressure her aching arm muscles could exert, she felt a tiny shift on the shelf. A change in the uniform drag of gravity so minute that it was more intuited than actually sensed. Wishful thinking, Jess. That's all you felt. Only that and nothing more. No. It was the input of senses which had been jacked into the stratosphere by terror, perhaps, but it wasn't wishful thinking. She let go of the shelf and just lay there for a few moments, taking long, slow breaths and letting her muscles recover. She didn't want them spasming or cramping up at the critical moment. She had quite enough problems without that, thanks. When she thought she felt as ready as she could feel, She curled her left fist loosely around the bedpost and slid it up and down until the sweat on her palm dried and the mahogany squeaked. Then she stretched out her arm and gripped the shelf again. It was time. Got to be careful, though. The shelf moved, no question about that, and it'll move more. But it's going to take all my strength to get that glass in motion. If I can do it at all, that is. And when a person gets near the end of their strength, control gets spotty. That was true, but it wasn't the kicker. The kicker was this. She had no feel for the shelf's tip point. Absolutely none at all. Jessie remembered seesawing with her sister Maddie on the playground behind Falmouth Grammar School. They had come back early from the lake one summer, and it seemed to her she had spent that whole August going up and down on those paint-peeling teeter boards with Maddie as her partner, and how they had been able to balance perfectly whenever they felt like it. All it took was for Maddie, who weighed a little more, to move a butt's length in toward the middle. Long, hot afternoons of practice, singing jump rope songs to each other as they went up and down, had enabled them to find each seesaw's tip point with an almost scientific exactitude. Those half a dozen warped green boards standing in a row on the sizzling hot top had seemed almost like living things to them. She felt none of that eager liveliness under her fingers now. She would simply have to try her best and hope that it was good enough. And whatever the Bible may say to the contrary, don't let your left hand forget what your right hand is supposed to be doing. Your left may be your ashtray-throwing hand, but your right had better be your glass-catching hand, Jessie. There's only a few inches of shelf where you'll have a chance to get hold of it. If it slides past that area, it won't matter if it stays up. It'll be as out of reach as it is right now. Jessie didn't think she could forget what her right hand was doing. It hurt too much. Whether or not it would be able to do what she needed it to do was another question entirely, though. She had increased the pressure on the left side of the shelf as steadily and as gradually as she could. A stinging drop of sweat ran into the corner of one eye, and she blinked it away. Somewhere the back door was banging again, but it had joined the telephone in that other universe. Here there was only the glass, the shelf, and Jessie. Part of her expected the shelf to come up all at once like a brutal jack-in-the-box, catapulting everything off, and she tried to steel herself against the possible disappointment. Worry about that if it happens, Toots. In the meantime, don't lose your concentration. I think something's happening. Something was. She could feel that minute shift again, that feel of the shelf starting to come unanchored at some point along Gerald's side. This time, Jessie didn't let up her pressure, but increased it, the muscles in her upper left arm standing out in hard little arcs that trembled with strain. She voiced a series of small, explosive grunts. That sense of the shelf coming unanchored grew steadily stronger. And suddenly, the flat, circular surface of the water in Gerald's glass was a tilted plane, and she heard the last slivers of ice chatter faintly as the right end of the board actually did come up. The glass itself did not move, however, and a horrible thought occurred to her. What if some of the water trickling down the sides of the glass had seeped beneath the cardboard coaster on which it sat? What if it had formed a seal, bonding it to the shelf? No, that can't happen. The words came out in a single whispered blurt, like a tired child's rote prayer. She pulled down harder on the left end of the shelf, using all her strength. Every last horse was now running in harness. The stable was empty. Please don't let it happen. Please. Gerald's end of the shelf continued to rise, its end wavering wildly. A tube of Max Factor blush spilled off Jessie's end and landed on the floor near the place where Gerald's head had lain before the dog had come along and dragged him away from the bed. And now a new possibility, more of a probability, actually, occurred to her. If she increased the angle of the shelf much more, It would simply slide down the line of L brackets, glass and all, like a toboggan going down a snowy hill. Thinking of the shelf as a seesaw could get her into trouble. It wasn't a seesaw. There was no central pivot point to which it was attached.
"Slide, you bastard!"
She screamed at the glass in a high, breathy voice. She had forgotten Gerald, had forgotten she was thirsty, had forgotten everything but the glass, now tilted at an angle so acute that the water was almost slopping over the rim, and she couldn't understand why it didn't simply fall over. It didn't, though. It just went on standing where it had stood all along, as if it had been glued to the spot.
Slide!
Suddenly, it did. Its movement ran so counter to her black imaginings that she was almost unable to understand what was happening. Later it would occur to her that the adventure of the sliding glass suggested something less than admirable about her own mindset. She had in some fashion or other been prepared for failure. It was success which left her shocked and gaping. The short, smooth journey of the glass down the shelf toward her right hand so stunned her that Jessie almost pulled harder with her left, a move that almost certainly would have overbalanced the precariously tilted shelf and sent it crashing to the floor. Then her fingers were actually touching the glass, and she screamed again. It was the wordless, delighted shriek of a woman who has just won the lottery. The shelf wavered, began to slip, then paused, as if it had a rudimentary mind of its own and was considering whether or not it really wanted to do this. "Not much time, Toots," Ruth warned. "Grab the goddamn thing while the grabbing's good." Jessie tried, but the pads of her fingers only slid along the slick, wet surface of the glass. There was nothing to grab, it seemed, and she couldn't quite get enough finger surface on the thrice-damned thing to grip. Water sloshed onto her hand, and now she sensed that even if the shelf held, the glass would soon tip over.
"Imagination, Toots. Just the old idea that a sad little pumpkin like you can never do anything right."
That wasn't far from the mark. It was certainly too close for comfort. But it wasn't on the mark. Not this time. The glass was getting ready to tip over. It really was. And she didn't have the slightest idea of what she could do to prevent that from happening. Why did she have to have such short, stubby, ugly fingers? Why? If only she could get them a little further around the glass. A nightmare image from some old TV commercial occurred to her. A smiling woman in a 50s hairdo, with a pair of blue rubber gloves on her hands. "So flexible you can pick up a dime," the woman was screaming through her smile. "Too bad you don't have a pair, little pumpkin, or goodwife, or whoever the hell you are. Maybe you could get that fucking glass before everything on the goddamn shelf takes the express elevator." Jessie suddenly realized the smiling, screaming woman in the playtex rubber gloves was her mother, and a dry sob escaped her. It was like some terrible omen that did not just suggest death, but guaranteed it.
"Don't give up, Jessie," Ruth yelled. "Not yet. You're close. I swear you are."
She exerted the last tiny scrap of her strength on the left side of the shelf, praying incoherently that it wouldn't slide. "Not yet. Oh, please, God, or whoever you are, please don't let it slide. Not now. Not yet." The board did slide, but only a little. Then it held again, perhaps temporarily snagged on a splinter or balked by a warp in the wood. The glass slid a little further into her hand, and now, crazier and crazier, it seemed to be talking too, the goddamn glass. It sounded like one of those grizzled big-city cab drivers who have a perpetual hard-on against the world.
"Jesus, lady, what else you want me to do? Grow myself a goddamn handle and turn into a fucking pitcher for you?"
A fresh trickle of water fell on Jessie's straining right hand. Now the glass would fall. Now it was inevitable. In her mind, she could already feel the freeze as ice water doused the back of her neck.
"No!"
She twisted her right shoulder a little farther, opened her right hand a little wider, let the glass slide a tiny bit deeper into the straining pocket of her hand. The cuff was digging cruelly into the back of that hand, sending jabs of pain all the way up to her elbow, but Jessie ignored them. The muscles of her left arm were twanging wildly now, and the shakes were communicating themselves to the tilted, unstable shelf. Another tube of makeup tumbled to the floor. The last few slivers of ice chimed faintly. Above the shelf, she could see the shadow of the glass on the wall. In the long sunset light, it looked like a grain silo blown a tilt by a strong prairie wind. More. Just a little bit more. There is no more. There better be. There's got to be. She stretched her right hand to its absolute tendon-creaking limit and felt the glass slide a tiny bit further down the shelf. Then she closed her fingers again, praying it would finally be enough, because now there really was no more. She had pushed her resources to their absolute limit. It almost wasn't. She could still feel the wet glass trying to squirm away. It had begun to seem like a live thing to her, a sentient being with a mean streak as wide as a turnpike passing lane. Its goal was to keep flirting toward her, and then squirming away until her sanity broke, and she lay here in the shadows of twilight, handcuffed and raving. "Don't let it get away, Jessie. Don't you dare, don't you dare let that fucking glass get away!" And although there was no more, not a single foot-pound of pressure, not a single quarter inch of stretch, she managed a little more anyway, turning her right wrist one final bit in toward the board. And this time, when she curved her fingers around the glass, it remained motionless. "I think maybe I've got it. Not for sure, but maybe. Maybe."